Confederation Line and Bus Service Update. Mr. Manconi, the floor is yours. And did you want Mr. Lausch to join you now?
Or? Yes, okay. Mr. Mayor, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lausch is here. He's going to be joining us. And I've got, and Mr. Slade also is here. I've got some introductory comments, and staff will do some comments, then we'll turn it over to Mr. Lausch. So good morning, everyone. As you know, at the last meeting, we advised you that RTG has hired JBA to assist them in a number of objectives, and that's, you know, to provide consistent service every single day and to fix things permanently so we have got a good road ahead for all our customers. Peter Lausch, after staff present, give you the verbal update, Peter is going to provide you with his update. First, Troy is going to walk you through the four issues that we've been tracking, the TCMS, the VOBC, the doors, and the switch issues. He's also going to touch on the latest issues that have come up, brakes and flats, and then the power issues with the vehicles, and high-level talk about interim and root causes, because I know Mr. Lausch is going to give you more detail in that regard, and then also on the bus service. Secondly, I've asked Pat to talk about a couple of things, the signage that is causing us all some aggravation out there in terms of not displaying the proper arrival times. Tunney's Pasture platform, when we go to a single platform operation, just why we're doing that, what's clarify some of the confusion out there on that also. And then his update on the Blair Station enhancements. He met with the ward councillors and walked them through that. Then I'm going to ask Michael to speak about Rideau and Parliament updates, and then I'm going to turn it over to Peter, who's going to talk about JBA's work, the fixes, and the responses to a number of questions that members of commission had at the last meeting. He's giving you a verbal update today. And then just before we dive into all that, on the fare freeze, you know, given where we are and based on the performance, we're going to continue with the fare freeze, and we're going to continue to monitor things and adjust the fare freeze in keeping with the council-approved motion that you approved last week. So the fare freeze will continue until the service stabilizes to our satisfaction. I'm now going to turn it over to Troy.
Thank you, John. Good morning. As reported at the January Transit Commission meeting, service ran well from mid-November to late December. However, since the end of December, there have been a high number of disruptions impacting customers. There have been some very good days, but also a number of days in January and February where customers' travel patterns and travel times have been significantly impacted. So much so, we had to develop and implement a new supplemental bus service that's been referred to as S1. I'll start by providing an update on the four issues that have been the primary causes of service disruptions, as previously reported to the Transit Commission, followed by an update on the recent events that have impacted our customers. And lastly, before I start, I'd like to mention that we're finalizing the biweekly issues update as requested by Councillor Gower, and we'll be issuing that update by the end of this week. With respect to the TCMS, throughout the month of January and so far in February, there has not been a TCMS-related service disruption since the software update the weekend of December 7th. With that said, the root cause of the TCMS problem is still unknown, and RTD are still taking proactive measures with vehicles when at the maintenance and storage facility to prevent TCMS failures from occurring while in service. So even though TCMS and, you know, train control, train control and monitoring system, just as a reminder, so even though the TCMS has not resulted in any recent service disruptions, it cannot be considered resolved. With respect to the VOBC, or Vehicle Onboard Controller, the number of VOBC occurrences has been trending very well, with several weeks without a single VOBC issue. However, last week, and again yesterday, there was a VOBC issue. While these recent occurrences did not result in delays, some customers may have been asked to board the next arriving train as staff conducted a VOBC reset at one of the terminus stations. Following this reset, in both instances, the train was able to return to service shortly thereafter. As previously communicated, there have been other VOBC occurrences while trains have been in operation. However, in those instances, due to the fact that there are built-in redundancies, service has not been impacted. On to doors. Door-related disruptions continue and are highly variable from week to week. We've had weeks with only one door-related event, for example, the week of February 3rd, whereas the week of February 10th, there were six. Depending on the nature of the occurrence, door disruptions can range from a minimal delay of a few minutes to a more significant impact, such as the implementation of R1 or rail replacement bus service. Over the past 3 weeks, and that's including yesterday, there have been 11 door-related issues which have resulted in short delays for some customers, rather than the implementation of R1, which is much more impactful for both bus and train customers. Door operations continue to be the most frequent cause of service disruptions. There have been adjustments to door mechanisms and processes that have improved staff's ability to isolate a door, which, as I previously reported, means take the door out of service but keeps the train in service. However, depending on the nature of the fault, if the operator is unable to isolate the door, customers may experience longer delays. Staff in our control center continue to monitor and adjust dwell times to reduce passenger interactions with doors. And a door software modification has been developed by RTG to improve door functionality and ultimately to reduce the number of door-related disruptions. This software is now undergoing the safety certification process, which is required prior to implementation with customers on board. In addition, external specialists have been brought in to validate that the updated functionality will improve the overall performance of the doors. I must point out, I appreciate our customers' continued support in that the message to not hold doors is being well received, and we will be continuing with this messaging. And I know later on Mr. Lauch will provide some additional information regarding the next steps with respect to the door safety certification. With respect to switches, over the past 3 weeks, there have been 8 switch or switch heater related disruptions that have impacted our customers. While six occurrences resulted in delays and single tracking, 2 occurrences have been more impactful as they required the implementation of R1 replacement bus service. In each occurrence, inclement weather has been a contributing factor. As a result of the continued service impacts, revised operating procedures have been implemented to assist in managing the switches during weather events and during service hours when trains are operating. New protocols have been implemented that allow guideway technicians, this is the RTG staff that maintain the track and the related infrastructure, allow the guideway technicians safe access to the track and switches while trains are in operation. This allows for greater proactive efforts to keep switches clear of ice and snow, as well as checks to ensure the proper functioning of the switch heater equipment. And I know that Mr. Lash will also provide some further details regarding the longer-term actions RTG is taking to improve the functionality of switches and ultimately to reduce the number of service impacts. Now, since late December, in addition to the 4 primary issues that have been causing service disruptions on Line 1, power and arcing events, as well as wheel flats, have caused either service interruptions or reduced fleet availability. With respect to power, since the last Transit Commission meeting, there have been 2 additional service disruptions that are attributed to arcing or power issues. Just as a simple reminder, most arcing events do not impact service and are common in rail systems that operate with an overhead catenary system. The 2 recent service disruptions occurred on January 25th and 26th and resulted in the implementation of single tracking and the implementation of R1 replacement bus service, respectively. To provide some additional context, the power that moves the trains is fed from the overhead catenary system, or OCS, to the train through the pantograph, and it goes through a series of electrical components on the roof of the train, including line inductors. And a line inductor is essentially a device that manages the electrical currents and prevents an electrical overload, and line contactors is essentially a switch which controls the power used to move the train. Although the root cause of these arcing and power events is still under investigation, it appears that it is the line inductors and contactors that are being impacted by this issue and are ultimately leading to the service failure. It's important to note that customers are safe and the electrical systems are functioning as intended to protect both the passengers and the train components. However, customers on trains or customers that are on platforms may observe the arcing, it's visual, or may hear a bang. RTG is in the process of undertaking several actions to contain and mitigate the issue while the root cause is still being investigated. RTG has previously completed a deep clean of the train roofs to remove the dirt and carbon on key electrical components. They are now in the process of improving the electrical insulation and modifying the rooftop covers to protect the rooftop components from further arcing and buildup of dirt and carbon. The insulation and the improved rooftop covers will make the components less susceptible to power and arcing issues. As a long-term measure, additional expertise in electrical train systems has been brought in to assist RTG in identifying the cause and develop permanent solutions. And again, I know that Mr. Louch will elaborate further on this. Lastly, wheel flats. You'll recall the last Transit Commission meeting that wheel flats was one of the primary contributing factors to the reduction in the number of vehicles available to meet daily service requirements. The fleet of dedicated R1 buses, as well as S1 buses, which were additional buses that were removed from daily service, were used to support customers during peak periods as a result. This impacted not only train, but also bus customers. Once the wheel flats occurred, trains had to be removed from service in short order and could not be returned until RTG was able to have the wheel flats corrected on a wheel lathe. The wheel flats limited the number of vehicles available for service and thereby reduced train frequency during peak periods when needed most. While the wheel flats did not specifically result in delays, the frequency of train service and ultimately our ability to transport customers at peak times was greatly reduced. Wheel flats most significantly impacted service the weeks of January 20th and 27th, as well as last week on Friday, February 14th, and into Saturday, February 15th. With respect to last week, and as communicated to Council on Friday, there was damage to four transponders located between Tunney's Pasture and Bayview stations, which caused several trains to break suddenly. This sudden braking resulted in wheel flats and subsequently the removal of four trains from service. Technicians were dispatched to replace the damaged transponders midday, which resulted in some longer commute times and a train transfer for customers traveling the West End while that work was being undertaken. And while the transponder issue was rectified, sometime around midday, due to the reduced fleet availability, trains operated at a reduced frequency for the PM peak period. And as I previously mentioned, this also continued into Saturday as well. Service is now operating with 13 vehicles at peak periods as a result of the efforts of RTG over the weekend to conduct all the necessary work on the wheel lays. However, RTG still needs to determine why so many wheel flats have been experienced recently. With respect to the bus side of the operation, we have noticed that service has stabilized and is generally providing a consistent service when Line 1 is operating normally, on schedule, with its full train allotment. However, when there are disruptions and a reduced fleet of light rail vehicles is available at peak times, bus service is also impacted. When train service is running as scheduled, we have seen a return in the consistency of the bus service to the pre-construction related detour levels. With that said, though, as always, we'll continue to collect feedback from our customers, from counselors and staff, and make adjustments to scheduled bus service during the quarterly service changes. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. First, I want to provide some information about the passenger information displays that show the time until the next train along Line 1. These are the electronic signs that you see hanging from the ceiling with the orange LED letters. These displays are on every platform of every station, showing the time until the next two trains. Plus, there are displays on the concourse level at the three underground stations that show the time of the next train in each direction. And there's a display on the concourse level at Tunney's Pasture Station showing the time of the next train going east from each of the two platforms. The times that are shown on those displays are straight from the signaling system that's controlling train movement. And for the most part, the information they provide is very useful and very reliable, and very, very reliable. When it says 1 minute, it's 1 minute. The displays also show in visual form any pre-recorded service and safety messages that are being announced over the PA system for people who are unable to hear the announcements. There are some times that these displays show something different than just the time until the next train. If there's a train passing through the station on its way to or from the yard, The display will show out of service for that next train. It'll say that this train's out of service and the following one is going to Blair or Tiny's Pasture. If there's an interruption to service, the display may show the word held or may show an alternate destination if trains are being turned back short of where they would normally go. And also at Tunney's Pasture, when we're running all of the trains out of one platform, which we do it sometimes to just make it easier for people to for customers to find the train, the other platform is marked platform closed. But in rare cases, the displays are showing erroneous or, as in the case yesterday, completely nonsensical times. And when that happens, we report that to RTG, and it's a matter for RTG and their subcontractors to follow up on. There are some discussions underway about changing the exact way things are displayed and what is the wording on this, and we're going back and forth with RTG's subcontractor on that, but that's a basic on what those passenger information displays show. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the bus platforms at Blair Station. Excuse me. On Friday the 7th of February, I met with the East End councillors to go over some potential improvements to the Blair Station bus platforms, especially the south platform, in order to address the congestion and improve customer flow and to address comments that had arisen from our staff and from our customers. So these improvements have been developed based on many suggestions from customers and staff, and in particular, I want to thank the operators and supervisors who've been working at Blair Station and on the routes serving Blair Station, as they've made observations which have really, really helped to develop and to assess different options. Thanks also to Councillors Dudas, Lulaf, Blais, and Tierney for meeting with me on site at Blair Station that day. And together we agreed on a plan forward to address concerns about congestion and improve the customer service, customer experience at Blair Station. And that plan includes the following actions. We're going to make changes to the bus stop assignments, which routes serve which stop along the south bus platform at Blair to more efficiently use the platform space, to use the space available better, and to group those routes geographically. So the routes that serve the north and southwest parts of Orleans will be at stop B. This is routes 25, 28, 38, and 237. The routes that serve the central part of Orleans will be at stop D. This is routes 30, 31, 32, 34, 39, 221, and 231. And the routes that serve the east part of Orleans will be at stop E. This includes routes 33, 35, 37, 232, 233, 234, 235, and 236. Most of those changes will be made with the April schedule change, the April service change on April 19th, because that allows us to provide all the information to customers at the same time and also allows us to change the customer information systems so that buses will continue to, as best as possible, show the right sign, the right display on the front of the bus as the bus pulls up. Sometimes when bus stops are moved without reprogramming all of those systems, the wrong displays are showing. But we're also going to make some of those changes earlier. Routes 25 and 28 will be moved over to stop B on March 8th to get an early win out of that. Just as a side away from Blair Station, just for a moment, we're also making changes to the bus platform at Herdman Station on March 8th. We're going to move Route 90 over from stop D to stop D, so that stop C to stop D, so that it'll be at the same stop as routes 92 and 290, which serve some common destinations. And we will get full information out to customers on all of these changes. We're starting a project to replace the elevator on the north side, on the north platform. This is an elevator that was not, it's a legacy elevator. It was not new with the Confederation Line project. It's only got one elevator, so it doesn't have the redundancy, and it's been failing an unreasonable amount of time. So we're working with our colleagues in Infrastructure Services and in the Rail Construction Program on making sure we've got the cost. We can work within Works in Progress and existing Capital Authority to line up the cost, the funding, and the timelines to get that done, and we'll provide you with updates as that work continues. We're also starting a project to replace the shelters, the individual shelters on the south side with with a new canopy that runs the full length with some wind baffles to give places for customers to stand. Like with the elevators, we're still working out exactly how that's going to be built and the cost and the how we're going to fund it and the timeline. So we'll provide. This is at Blair Station. And the other thing that we're still looking at Blair, and we're not positive it's going to work out yet, is that we're looking at the feasibility to establish a third exit down off the train platform to the South Bus platform. There's a corridor at the east end that is currently only used for maintenance access, not for customer movement. And so we're looking at whether it's possible to build another staircase down off the bus platform into this corridor, make the customer the corridor safe for customers, and that would give them a third route out onto the south bus platform for eastbound buses towards Orleans. And the third thing I wanted to talk about was the supplementary service that we've been running the last few weeks, the S1 service, direct to downtown from Tunney's Pasture, Herdman, and Blair in the morning, and direct to those three stations from downtown in the afternoon. We've been continuing to run that, and we will continue to run that because it's helping customers on days when there's been delays on the train service or when there's been a shortage of trains on the line. We'll continue to allocate our 20 dedicated R1 buses, the ones with the yellow labels on the side, to this S1 service. First of all, it provides, there's already a supplement in place in case there's any problems with train service. Second, the buses are already in place in case there's any bigger problem that requires us to put replacement bus service in. The buses are already in the area. So we're going to continue to run that until we see, as John's talked about, stability and consistent good service on the line. We're watching usage of it, customer ridership every day. As you can imagine, ridership is higher on it on days when there are problems with the train and lower when the train is moving well. So we'll continue to operate it. We continue to advise customers of it every day. And when we find that it's no longer needed by customers or no longer needed to back up the train, we will let you know. So I'm turning you over to Michael Morgan now.
Thank you, Pat. So I wanted to provide an update to Commission on the smells. We have smells at two locations now. Obviously, the most recent one is Rideau Station. Peter Louch will give you some more of the technical details on there's at least two minor spots where we see a little bit of water. They've contained that for the time being, but they do need to come back probably later in the year to do some injection grouting. There was at least one failed gasket in the station back rooms, leading to certainly smells in the equipment rooms themselves that was kind of matching the smell that was out in the open areas where the customers would have smelt it and experienced it, unfortunately. So I'll leave the technical details to Peter on that, but I just wanted to confirm for Commission that working with the Chief Safety Officer and with Ottawa Public Health and a few others who've since been engaged in the process, just air quality testing was undertaken, and a report was provided to me, a copy of it, late Monday night, which indicated that there are no health concerns with the tunnel at that location. So I just want to provide that assurance that the testing was completed, and we have a copy of that test report. Otherwise, the last commission, Peter reported on a series of things that were kind of essentially investigative actions and different technical avenues that were investigated to see what the potential root cause at Parliament Station was. I don't believe there's a definitive answer at this point, but in terms of kind of other technical things that are going on and other actions, I'll pass it to Peter for his feedback.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, Mr. Chair. So I'll run through, I'll sort of follow Troy's order and then give you an update on where we are with some of the task force teams. And then I'm sure you'll have some questions for Mr. Slade and myself afterwards. So following in the order that that Mr. Charter took, absolutely on the TCMS side, it has been stable. We don't have the root cause analysis yet, but it is stable. And we're not taking our foot off the gas. We're still going to follow up on that. But some of the resources that we had on the TCMS task force team, we've got them prioritizing some other technical task force teams right now. On the VOBC side, it is trending well. There is a software upgrade that's planned. It requires quite a bit of cooperation with the city, with the stakeholders in the project for us. We were trying to fit it in. It's quite intrusive. It takes EROs. We need 4 vehicles during some engineering hours. We have to run some tests over 2 weekends. Then we extract the software. It goes back to Talos for safety certification. What we've been doing is we're trying to expedite the implementation of this software now in conjunction with the city, because this upgraded software will deal with some of the VOBC issues, but it also deals with some of the other issues that I'll talk about in a moment, even brakes and EBs and so forth. There's an interface there. So we can talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But as I can corroborate what Troy said, that the VOBC issues are trending well. On the door side, I acknowledge that we've had several door delays, including one today. The door delay that was occurred yesterday, and I think most of the ones that we've had recently, will be mitigated with an upgraded software. So it's a software that doesn't compromise safety. What it does, though, it allows more cycling. So if somebody does, it won't help if somebody actually tries to pull on the door and create an eccentric load on it, but if someone tries to block the door, it allows it to cycle a few more times. This software the software has been done. It's been tested. We demonstrated it to the city in the shed as well, and now it has to go through a safety certification process. So the documentation has been compiled. It's being submitted to an independent third-party engineer, and this independent third-party engineer will provide what they call a SIL-2 certificate, so it's a safety integrity level. And that process, it's pretty much out of our hands. It's an independent engineer who's going to go through all the documentation, go through the code, and we're hoping that we have the okay to start implementing this new software in mid-April. There is a task force team as well, though, on the doors. We're looking into not just the upgraded software, but there's some other elements that we're looking at as well. The switches, and I'm glad Mr. Charter said switch heaters, because it's not really a switch issue. The issue has been with the switch heaters, and that's what's caused the performance of the switch, and that's why we've had disturbed switches. We have a switch heater task force team. And that includes representatives from all the players, from ORTC, from RTM, RTG, JBA, as well as the manufacturer. And we've come up with some prototype ducting. We've modified the ducting twice now. We did a prototype ducting modification about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, and it was fairly successful. And since then, we've gone through another iteration where we've extended the ducting, and it looks like a tuning fork, where we've separated the ducting and it's targeting the heat directly to the tongue and the stock rail at the switches. And we put that on switch 327 at Blair, and it's been performing quite well. So yesterday we did have a switch issue at Blair, but it was 328, it was on the opposite side. But this switch 327 with the modified ducting so far has been successful. We've ordered material because we're quite confident that it is a good interim solution. So we've already ordered material, and we're planning to install some of this ducting this weekend if we can. As Mr. Charter mentioned, I mean, one of the ways that we're trying to mitigate delays is to have more guideway techs access the switches quicker. So yesterday morning, part of the winter plan was we had 4 crews of guideway techs roving, and we've been working together with the city to be able to jump on a disturbed switch that much quicker, establish a safe zone, and then single track where we can. And it worked. I do acknowledge that there was a delay yesterday due to the switch at Blair, but the actual rectification of it was much quicker than it has been in the past. Between the permitting, so as you can imagine, a switch goes disturbed, we can't just jump on the track, we have to go through the TOCC. There's a permitting process that we have to go through. But between having the people there, they were in situ, and the permitting process, it took about 23 minutes to clear the tongue, but the actual work took about 6 minutes. But the process of establishing the safe zone, getting the permits, that's what was that was time consuming, and we're still working with the city to see if we can't improve that. As far as the the arcing is concerned, as Mr. Charter said, the last events we had were end of January. Subsequent to those events, all the inductors had been cleaned. That was one of the short-term mitigations that we invoked. So all the inductors have now been cleaned. And the inductors, as Mr. Charter described, it's a great big, quite heavy, weighs about 1,000 pounds, and what it does, it allows it the current to be absorbed, almost filtered, if you will. So when we connect to the power, it's designed so there's not a huge current inrush. We've had some problems with that. That was, we think that's one of the causes of the arcing that we had on New Year's Eve and then the incidents that we had in early January. And one of the mitigations was to do a thorough clean, a combination of carbon buildup, the salt, and the pre-melt treatment that comes with the salt. That was coating the inductors, and that was, and then coupled with some small cracks in the inductor, and in water, we basically were creating a bit of a battery there. So that's since been mitigated. We've cleaned the inductors. When Mr. Charter talks about insulation, it's really insulators. So it's glastic. So it's a channel that we put in between the inductors and the steel supports to mitigate any kind of current path. So that's the medium term mitigation that's underway right now. And in conjunction with that, the inductors are open air. They're open to atmosphere. And because we found some issues in the manufacturing process that had some cracks in them, and that's when, as I said, with the carbon buildup in the water. So one way to mitigate that is to try to protect them from the weather. So we have roofs, basically chimneys that are sitting on top of the inductors. It's an engineered solution because these are air-cooled inductors, so you have to maintain the airflow through over the inductor. Those have now been installed on two train sets. So and the insulators as well. We have ordered. So we're doing a fast track order. We have 38 roof sections in stock, and as the vehicles come in for maintenance, we are retrofitting them with these the roofs. In addition to that, we've increased, even with the roofs, we've increased the frequency of the inspections. So rather than doing it based on a 25,000 kilometer interval, we're doing it based on a monthly basis. So these are now being, even with the insulation or the insulators, and the roof, we're checking these now every 2 months. As far as the long-term solution is concerned, the long-term solution is replacing the inductors. And that requires an engineering solution, that requires, it's a manufacturing process that is underway, but that's about 12 months away to start swapping out all the inductors. In the meantime, we're quite confident that the mitigations that we have in place are successful. So most of the problems we've been having with the arcing was during certain weather patterns. And one of the weather patterns that seems to be conducive to this issue was what we experienced yesterday. Snow, there was a bit of rain, there was some freezing drizzle, temperature fluctuations. And we had no issues yesterday. The inductors performed quite well. And that was primarily due to the ones that we had cleaned and then the two vehicles, or the two train sets, I should say, that have the roofs on them. So we're going to continue down that path, and we estimate that we'll have roofs on all the inductors within the next 4 to 6 weeks, if not less. We're continuing. We do have a task force team on the arcing issue. As I said, we do believe that not the sole root cause, but one of the most likely culprits is the inductor. And when we talk about contactors and pantographs, it's all related. and it starts at the inductor. So it's a bit of a domino effect. If your inductor has a problem, then there's a domino effect that goes to the contactors and then the pantograph. So resolving the inductor issue, we're quite confident that will mitigate that. In addition, so our arcing team is not just looking at that, but it's also looking at the infrastructure to make sure that our overhead catenary line is fit for purpose. We're looking at that interface with the vehicles as well. And this task force team, we have expertise from the RTG partner companies. We also have expertise from an Alstom facility that designed the entire electrical system for the vehicles. They're in situ. They're here in Ottawa, participating in the task force teams. JBA is managing or is chairing the task force teams for us. And there's also participation from Alstom, RTM, RTG, and OLRTC. We're moving forward. I think the task force teams have been working together quite successfully. And we don't have all the root causes yet, but we're definitely converging on solutions. So I'll be happy to update the commission next time you convene. The other task force team that we have underway, again, it's chaired by JBA. It has to do with the wheel flats, and the wheel flats. It's a combination of things. It's a brake issue and a wheel flat issue. Where we are with that right now is we've got expertise from the brake manufacturer here. We've got, again, additional expertise from our in-house partners, in addition to the engineers and the technicians on staff at RTM and Alstom here in Ottawa, meeting on a regular basis. We don't have a root cause yet, but again, look at what happened yesterday. A lot of the EBs, the emergency brake situations that we've been having, were during certain weather, and that weather was similar to what we had yesterday. So yesterday, one way to mitigate it in cooperation with the city, at the start of the day, we invoked a type 2 brake acceleration system, and you would have felt it public if you were riding the trains, because in certain instances it was going a little bit slower, longer stopping distances, slower acceleration, and so forth. But what that did, that seemed to mitigate the EBs. We had no EBs yesterday, at least I don't believe so, and no EBs usually means no flats. So that's one of the areas we're looking at in our task force team, and this ties back into some of the CBTC software. The upgrade that we want to do as well, there's an interface in there because the CBTC controls the speed and can also dictate if an EB is invoked. EBs can also be invoked through the GIDS, which is the Guideway Intrusion Detection System. So at the end of the platforms, at Blair, Tunney's, for example, you won't see it, but there's a laser detection system, so it's Guideway Intrusion. During inclement weather, as we had yesterday morning, we agreed with the city that we would be doing, temporarily turn off the GIDS, and we would have observers there at the end of the stations, because sometimes the GIDS, even if it's horizontal snow, for example, it might trip, and then that creates an EB. So that's not the long-term solution, of course. That's a mitigation, and that's part of the winter plan. And that was one of the elements that we review and agree with the city before a winter event. So on Monday evening, we went through that in great detail with the city, and we mutually agreed that although it does affect performance, it does affect the number of kilometers that we do, it does affect the speed of the train, it was a good conservative mitigation. In terms of I'm just going through the list here. I don't have a lot of information for you at this point with the PIDS, which is the passenger information display system. We had done a reboot of the SRS, which is the schedule regulation server. We think that might have been the root of some of the problems, but I don't have the information with me right at this moment, but I'll be following up with Mr. Scrimger later on today. The other issue that Mr. Morgan raised is regarding the smells. At Rito, we did an investigation. We tried to determine where the source was, and we think we actually may have found it. So in the lower HVAC room, so you don't see it, but when you come down the bottom of the stairs at Rito Station in the east entrance, there's an HVAC room, a heating, ventilation, air conditioning room, and there's a sump pit in that room. And some of our ORTC partners were down there, and a week and a half ago, they inspected it, and there was a sump pit that basically was emitting the smell that you recognize in the station. There was a gasket, the seal that was not broken, but it wasn't performing as it should, and the odor was coming out of that. So they removed the seal, they sanitized the sump pit, they put in some deodorizers, and then they're in the process of replacing the gasket for a more permanent solution. But since then, and I haven't checked Twitter this morning, but since then I haven't heard if this spell has reoccurred at Rito. The Parliament one is a bit more challenging. Since we last met and I told you we were going to take some action, we had cleaned and gotten and done CCTV inspections of all the sanitary lines. We had re-cleaned out the sump pits for the escalator pits and sanitized them, and thinking that might mitigate the smell, but I heard recently that there were still some complaints. It's not consistent. It seems to be intermittent. So we have to go back and see if we can find the source of that. Even so much as we're looking at the surface to see if there's something that's coming through the tunnel ventilation shafts. And as I said, it doesn't seem to be consistent. So we're even looking at garbage pickup cycles to see if that has an impact if we're happening to, you know, if we're removing something on those particular days. Sorry, I forgot to mention, as Mr. Morgan mentioned, we did do an air quality test. We had an environmental company come in, do an air quality test, and I shared those results with Mr. Morgan. I promised I'd share them with council. I got an email address yesterday, and I'll be distributing that information through that address. Some of the other items that I took away from the last council meeting was some information on the switch heaters. So I'll be sharing that again in the same email. There were some questions on, have these switch heaters been used in similar environments? Absolutely. The company that we bought the switch heaters from is a company called Spectrum. They're in the States, in Ohio. They've provided them in other places in Ontario, in other places in Quebec, in Manitoba as well, I believe. I have a list, and I'll distribute that to council in this email later on today, that identifies where they are. So they definitely have experience in this environment. They recognize that we have to do some modifications, so they're part of our task force team. One of the other takeaways I took was there was a request for some information on the train-to-train pull. We have a specification. We've not done the test yet. We're trying to schedule that with everything else that's going on, but I'm happy to share that procedure. And I think that's it for the time being. I'm sure you have some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lausch, Scrimger, Mr. Charter, Mr. Morgan, for the presentation. There no speakers. We have David Jeans. Perhaps before we go to commissioner questions. David Jeans had to go. Okay. I have Commissioner Williams on the list. I don't know if she's coming back. So, okay. There you go. Commissioner... Councillor Tierney.
And Sarah wants on after this. Sarah wants on.
Great. Thank you very much, Vice Chair. And thank you for the very lengthy presentation today. I have a few questions, and since it kind of covered a whole bunch of different areas, I'll start with what I consider some of the better news. I want to thank John and Pat, your team, for joining the Eastern Bloc councillors. I know Matt's here with me today, and we're quite happy with a lot of the suggestions. The route changes, that's the low-hanging fruit that's easier to implement, versus the canopy, which will give coverage for people in those rainstorms and snow events. All about promise less, deliver more. The canopy is something that is most likely achievable within the next 6 to 8 months, depending on engineering and all the diagramming and all that sort of stuff. Would that be fair? A fair assessment?
I don't have a problem with that assessment, but I don't have one for you. So we're going to do our work and move it along as quickly as we can, while making sure we answer all the technical questions.
No, for sure. And again, I'm not trying to put you in a position on that one. It's more on the elevator front, and it's unfortunate Kyle had to leave because Councillor Luloff and I have been working with the accessibility community, specifically with Kyle. And this is a big deal because explain the process right now when that one little rinky-dink elevator breaks down all the time, what we actually have to do as a transit company to accommodate people.
So what we do when that elevator is broken down is, or it's just out of service, is we assign a bus to carry people from the north side around to the south side. So we'll pick them up in a bus on the north bus platform and just loop it around to the south bus platform, or the other way, from the south to the north, because there's no other way to get in and out of the station.
And that's
for someone with a disability who requires, or anyone who requires the elevator.
And so on that, that's why we're very excited to hear about, of course, you talk about additional capacity through different stairwells and all that, but I think the elevator is probably one of the most key part from a redundancy point of view and our accessibility community. And I know that there's some financials attached to that wouldn't, I don't think, believe, be all through the transit company. It could be through the city as well. Would that be correct?
Well, we're going to find the right funding source within the existing capital authority from council.
So, okay.
Only if we need more authority or a decision or approval to reallocate would be coming back to you.
Okay, good. And I just want to make sure if there's any challenges with that. I see this as a pretty big priority. If you need the leverage of transit commissioners or council, I think the story tells itself. If we want to be able to make it that much more of a system for our accessibility community. As I'm going through, I noticed when we were talking about the signaling system and how snow really affects things and all these software upgrades that are going to take place. We only have a couple more months of snow, but it's still a couple more months. Are you doing these software upgrades? Can they? My fear is if we're making these software upgrades, are you confident? Like, are we doing quality assurance testing on the software upgrades in advance? Like, I come from a technology background, and it's like you have dev QAS in production. Are you running environments like that instead of, because when you, unfortunately, when you go to production, most times you can't back out of it. So how does that look?
The signaling system provided by Thales is fully safety certified and goes through, as Peter said, so the software gets installed, tested in a live environment over a couple of weekends with trains, etc. The software is then pulled back out, regressed back to the previous version of software, and that software is then, one that's been tested, is then removed back to the testing house to be retested and validated before it is then put back into service. So it goes through a rigorous safety test protocol, which can take about up to 6 weeks before it gets safety certified after it's been tested in the field.
Okay, and my next question, only because people ask about it all the time, is I know we're not there yet for making use of the buttons. In this cold environment, it would be certainly handy if we were actually doing that at this point, where we don't have to open all the doors and all the cars. When would that be coming into play as a software update or a modification to the programming?
So I think we're probably ready to do it now, but it's something that we need to agree with the city. We have had some discussions on it. There is a software upgrade that we're still doing on the in addition to the software upgrade that I mentioned about the repeated cycle. There's still a few other tweaks that we have to do. And to be frank with you, we have to have that discussion with the city. So I don't know if either Mr. Charter or anybody else wants to intervene.
Mr. Mayor, I just want to clarify. I think the councillor was asking about the door activation buttons, not the Thales software. So the door buttons, we're a long way away from that. Even if it was technically viable, think of the long list of things that need to get done. And what I'm doing is I'm being the gatekeeper. I'm not going to push something out and risk service. We have to get consistent service. And the push button functionality, we all want that. But just on the customer interface piece in terms of getting that message out is an exercise unto itself. So, you know, you've heard about Talus upgrade, software upgrade for the doors and so forth. That's that big matrix. And Councillor Tierney, you and I had discussions with the Presto rollout stuff. So Mr. Lausch knows we're very cautious. They have a great process with Talus and so forth. That's all industry best practices. But we got to look at it globally in terms of all the other things that we got on the to-do list. And the challenge, as they both said, is getting those test vehicles through that process. So, you know, get that done, get the flats done, get the VOBC tested, get the TCMS tested. So a lot of, I just don't want anybody to leave the room thinking the door issue is around the corner. We would all love it. It helps them, helps us, helps the customers and so forth, but we're a ways away from the door issue.
And completely support your rationale behind that. Absolutely. It's more about, I'm already planning for next winter, and that's where I'm headed to is, are we going to be, and I can wait for a future meeting and we can talk offline about it, by next winter, you know, let's face it, we've been kind of blessed this winter. It's been not overly bad. It has been super cold. But when it's, you know, feels like minus 40 out there, I don't think we're going to get as lucky next winter. I have a funny feeling we're going to get hit again. And I'd like to have some confidence that we'll be using the push buttons by that point. So I don't know if you want to just take that away and then maybe come back at a future date and discuss if that will be in place by next winter. And last, the signaling system, this is the same one that Edmonton was plagued with problems with, I believe. And they have snow as well. Do you know much about the Edmonton system, the Thiel system, in comparison to ours with the switch heaters, et cetera?
If I may just qualify one thing. When I said about the snow, it wasn't really in relation to the CBTC system itself. It has to do with the GIDS, so the guideway intrusion detection system. So the way the system works is the guideway intrusion detection system, which is the laser protection system at the end of the platform. So if somebody, if an animal or you know, if it detects it, it then invokes an EB on the train. That GIDS, you know, we'll go to a sort of a manual system 4 or 5 times a year. That's weather dependent. The CBTC system is not weather dependent, so I should have clarified my statement. So it's really just the GIDS itself and that interface with the CBTC.
Okay, so just again, are you familiar with Edmonton and how they had their challenges with their Thiel system at all?
I know that they had some challenges, Councillor, but I don't know the details.
Okay, I'm just trying to see if there's a best practices white paper out of this, maybe that they have that they could share with us, if there is similarities between the signaling, the heaters, whatever the case may be. I just know they wrestled with it for 8 months, and if they learned things that they could share with us, we should listen.
Mr. Chair, I'm very familiar with the Edmonton situation. It was Talus, but it was a totally different environment. They were doing retrofits to an existing line. Give credit where credit is due. Talus system here is working very, very well. As you heard the independent safety reviewer, Mr. Barata, talk about the redundancies. All our redundancies are working very well. And the GID system is not a Talus component. It talks to the Talus system. But we're very, very aware of the Edmonton situation, and quite frankly, a lot of agencies are coming to us on the Talus piece because it is working well, and RTM is managing them well.
Great.
On the Talus system.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor Brockington, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excellent update. Thank you. A few questions. In some of the downtown stations, there is a liquid that's permeating through the wall. You can see it dripping down. What is that, and what's causing it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that liquid that you see permeating through the wall, that's it's a waterproofing solution. So it's a solution that we injected to mitigate leaks. It has a long-term activation.
Okay.
So in some cases, you'll see it still come out over the next month or so. And in fact, that injection. So we talked last time about there was water coming through an expansion joint at Rideau Station. So we've got a temporary fix for that now. We've got a troughing system to divert the water so it doesn't go on the trains or on the catenary system. But we'll be using that product in that area to seal that leak. You won't see it. It's in the tunnel. But what you're seeing, the black ooze or the grayish ooze. So it's a time, like I said, depending on where it's activated, it takes time to activate. And what it does, it expands. Yeah. So what you're seeing, it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. It's filling the crack, but the excess is coming through.
So you'll wait until that completes, then you'll scrape it, repaint it.
So what we'll do is, as it comes through, we'll be cleaning it, and then if it requires repainting, yes, absolutely.
Okay. To Mr. Manconi or Scrimger, can we just get an update on the new driver hires, buses? How are the classes?
First class graduated and was out on February 7th, 6th of the 7th. There was 19 out of 22 or 23 made it through.
Good.
Second class is already in, and then we're also doing para drivers and electric rail operators.
And that's good news. Great. Number of trains, we've asked you before about when we think we'll be able to add capacity to the Confederation line. There's been some chatter as of late that when you've provided us updates before rush hour starts, which I very much appreciate that you're mentioning the 13 trains full service, but we do have capacity for more. When can we, in all likelihood, see the 14th train as part of full service?
So I'll go first, and then I'd like Mr. Lausch to build on that. So the 14th train has gone through and passed most of the testing. We have two remaining technical issues that need to be resolved. There's some good discussions being had on that. And then there's a bunch of administrative things, sign-offs, deckling, and things like that need to be done. We're as anxious as everybody else to get that 14th train launch and 15th so that it frees up a lot of capacity. Schedule's written, it's ready to go, so that gets loaded up in the Talus system. But we are down to two technical issues, and there's a debate about those issues, and we've got our vehicle experts engaged and Mr. Lausch's team. I think we're close. No firm date right now. Mr. Lausch may want to comment.
But are these trains not ready for service yet because of RTG, RTM? Like, I'm trying to figure out why the 14th and 15th trains aren't service ready now. So
we're talking about two different things. So, okay. So the what Mr. Manconi was alluding to was one of the stage two trains that we're going through testing, and we're hoping to do a test tomorrow together with the city to deal with these two outstanding technical issues. And then that will then set the path forward to go through the acceptance process. As Mr. Manconi said, it's a bit of an administrative process. We have to go through a car history book, review all the quality assurance reports. It takes a little bit over a week to do that. But we're close to that, and in the meantime, the other vehicles from stage two, we're doing burn-in during engineering hours, and so we're confident that they'll be ready for acceptance within the next few weeks. What you're alluding to is getting the 14th and 15th vehicles into service during rush hour.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, the state we're in, with some of the issues that we've been struggling with the wheel flats and the arcing, our objective every morning, right now the agreement we have with the city is 13 during peak period plus a hot spare, and that's been our objective, that's been our target. Our ultimate objective obviously is to get 15 during peak, but with the issues that we're having, we're just not at that point yet. Once we get some of these mitigations in place for the arcing issues, the roof structures, and even some of the door improvements, then we'll be in a position to have that discussion with the city and offer up the 14th and then eventually the 15th vehicle.
Okay, and just so I'm clear, is anything less than 15 full trains in rush hour service not meeting the contractual obligations between RTGM and the city, and that way the clause can be triggered that a non-full maintenance payment, does that trigger a non-full maintenance payment?
It's less about a maintenance payment. When we during revenues, when we achieved revenue service, we had an agreement with the city that we would launch 13 vehicles at peak, but our contractual obligation is 15. So the city gave us a concession to do 13 plus a hot spare until that time that we were comfortable with
okay.
the additional vehicles.
Let me ask you this. If you run 13 trains for an entire month, no issues, will you be getting a full payment for that month?
I would hope so, yes.
Okay. I'm trying to get at whether or not the city is expecting 15 trains to run blemish-free or 13. So that's what I'm trying to get at. Do we know the answer? Is it 15 or 13?
I'm reluctant to answer right now. I'm looking at Mr. O'Connor because I think we're going to. Well, he's just saying, "Don't look at him." But no, I'm not going to. I don't want to trip up here, and we're getting into some legal debates or discussions with Mr. Lausch and his team. Your question is very valid and very on point.
And I'm more concerned about capacity.
I'm with you.
I don't want to get into an open legal battle. That's not my intent. I just want to make sure if we're all aiming towards getting 15 trains on to alleviate some of our capacity, that's where I'm going with my question.
We told you when we launched 13 trains can carry the volume that we have. Their number, they told us when they bid the job, for the projected ridership forecast at the time, which was way over 100 million, needed 15. We're not there, as you know. You've seen our ridership. We can carry our volume, and yes, it's uncomfortable for some people, but I can get into a long discussion about the space ratio and carrying capacity and all that, but I don't want to bore you with that detail. But in terms of payments, I don't want to do this in this open forum because I'm not going to get myself into a situation where you're not getting a complete story or there's bits and pieces to that. And I can tell you right now, as I've said before on the public record, he's already debating me on October, November, and December. So I don't want to have that debate in a public forum, and I look to legal because I think that's best kept in the space where they're challenging us on certain things. I'm not trying to be combative with them. I'm after 13 vehicles every single day because I want to release those 20 buses to get you the good bus service that everybody's talking about. Remember, those are supposed to be out serving our customers. So I'm not trying to be difficult, Councillor. 13. Do I want the 14th vehicle? Yes. I think once we launch that 14th vehicle, we'll be fine. 15, there'll be lots of room during peak.
Okay. Thank you. My last question, Mr. Chair, is just regarding some localized issues, bus issues in my ward. Is it best for us to sit down? There's three routes in particular that continue to cause issues, 85, 92, and 111. It's capacity issues. So I don't think it's an issue for the commission to worry about now, but I do want to just flag them publicly. We're still having issues, 85, 92, and 111, and would just like to sit down with OC at some point soon to review those routes.
Yes, we'll book time with you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Councillor. Can I just ask whose ever phone keeps going off or around the table or the side table there, if they could turn off their notifications during the meeting so it's not a distraction for everybody? Okay, next up is Commissioner Caricato, please, followed by Commissioner Wright Gilbert.
Hey there. I'm wondering about Tunney's Pasture and if similar changes are coming to Tunney's like you're proposing for Blair on terms of the platform and getting people around in the doors and alleviating some of the crowding.
So, Mr. Chair, we started with some changes at Tunney's Pasture very early on, and the reason the Blair is following is because there was less space. So you'll remember that we expanded the north platform quite a bit by taking the one lane of the federal roadway that's there, moving the fence back. We followed that up by building a temporary canopy over the length of that expanded platform. We also expanded the platform on the south side and put up a temporary canopy there. And we also took down the doors, which had been required to walk out and then walk around the horseshoe curve to the north platform, and replaced that, RTG replaced that with a vertical door that is closed at night. So those changes have been made at Tunney's Pasture. Similar changes were made at Herdman Station. We expanded the platform to the north and put in a temporary canopy over that. Blair needed a different approach because Blair didn't have the ability to build back beyond the retaining walls that were in place. So Blair requires more of a permanent solution than a temporary solution. But we are also looking at what is the best way to continue the benefits of the temporary solutions at Tunney's Pasture and at Herdman, and should we be recommended to council or under our capital authority making any investments there on the parts of the station that are going to be permanent that don't go away after stage two opens.
Okay, what about inside the station? I met with a rider, daily rider. She says it takes her 7 minutes to get off the train to exit the station at Tunney's to the two doors, I guess, heading towards stop D. Wondering if you have any, if I'm not the only one mentioning this, or if you've heard this from others and what you're working on.
We'd be happy to hear the specifics of that so we can understand the problem.
Okay, sounds good. And then I guess once you do finally get out the doors at Tunney's Pasture and you're waiting on the platform, I guess there's, I personally don't take the bus at Tunney's, so I'm following the, I guess, report here that I got from this individual. But apparently there are quite a few idling buses, and she's concerned about the quality of the air while she's waiting for the bus. Is there any report on that?
The bus staging area is in the center of the station, and it's generally similar to what would be at any major bus terminal in any major city. Our modern buses are very low in emissions. I don't know what specifically this customer might be looking for.
Okay, I'll follow up with you then on that. She was also asking about safety. So if there were, God forbid, some kind of an event where she needed to get out of that situation quickly at Station D, her options were to jump the fence or to go back in through the station. Is that correct? And what is the emergency procedures?
There are three exits from the station. There's an exit onto Scott Street, there's an exit onto Tunney's Pasture Boulevard, and there's an exit at the northwest corner, out at the corner of Yarrow and the other street I can't remember the name of right now, the federal internal roadway. So there's three exits from the station for normal use. General evacuation procedures, if something ever went wrong on a station platform in the past, on the transitway, have included shutting down the transitway and having people walk on the bus roadway. So there's no, you know, it's not a physical restriction of space there. It's just that the buses are moving in front, so normally you wouldn't want people in the bus space. But if you can shut down the buses, then that becomes a safe evacuation route, as it is at any of the transitway stations that we've been running for 35 years now.
I think Troy was talking, or it was you maybe, about the importance of having the sort of time of arrival down in the station or in the tunnel. Is there any discussion about having that outside the station so riders may make an informed decision about whether they get down or in or out?
I don't understand the time of arrival of what service?
Of the trains.
So at Tunney's Pasture,
you have to get into the station before you know what time the train is arriving or how frequent, right?
On the upper level, so there's five displays which currently show the time of the next departure of the train. They don't show the arrivals of the train. They show that at Tunney's Pasture specifically.
That's what I meant,
yeah. They show departure times. Two are on the south platform, two are on the north platform, and one is on the concourse level. So it's not necessary to go down to the platform level to know when the next train is coming. The big sign on the ceiling at the concourse level does the same.
Okay, and just one bus-related question. In response, I think this was an inquiry from Councillor Dudas. You talk about sort of minimizing cancellations, assessing all options to cover service. And then there's a line, extra buses with operators are strategically placed on standby at locations across the city in order to make quick adjustments to service. Out of curiosity, where are these locations?
Mr. Chair, we do have what we call, the term extras is the term used within OC Transpo. These are operators that are booked on a piece of work in which they're assigned to a specific location. They're generally at locations located along the transitway throughout the city as well. They're generally in locations where we also have a supervisor who could assign them the work. So places like Tunney's Pasture, Herdman, Blair Stations. But it varies depending on time of day, as well as direction of travel of our peak period service. But, during peak periods, it's, I don't know the exact number, but it's approximately 15 buses with operators that are strategically placed. And as I said, they're usually located along portions of the transitway so where they can access quickly to get to a route that they need to start, and areas that, you're trying to cover as large area as possible with that resource.
So would it be fair to say that there were 15 strategically placed around the city yesterday?
Obviously I'm not counting the R1 buses, but, depending on the time of day, peak periods, we would have those resources out. I said it could fluctuate a little bit from day to day, but generally speaking, yes.
So it is impacted by R1 or the S1, the number of buses that are strategically placed?
No, I'm just making the point that the R1 buses, S1 buses are separate and apart from these resources. But these resources are, they're generally not sitting idly by. I mean, every day we're reacting and responding to, traffic congestion, collisions, there could be other things going on. So every day we're utilizing those resources in an effort to fill in gaps and provide a reliable service. So although we have these resources out there, we are heavily using them as well, and that's to provide the service to our customers.
Is it more or less than last year, like the number of strategically placed buses?
I would have to verify, but I believe it's approximately the same number.
Okay, where I'm going with this is it's Transit Challenge Week here in Ottawa, and I was waiting for the number 6 or 7 on bank yesterday, and 2 buses came by completely full. Finally, the third one came. I was lucky, I suppose. I got on the last spot on the bus, but there were several other people waiting behind me. And then we drove by numerous people waiting at every stop down Bank Street. And this is between the Glebe, so say 5th Avenue and Parliament Station. And I was just wondering if, there were any standby locations in that proximity to alleviate some of that, lack of capacity on the buses.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I believe we do have Billings Bridge is one of the locations, but that's something I'd gladly follow up and provide the additional information.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Commissioner. Commissioner Wright-Gilbert, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something that Mr. Lausch said when he was speaking. I am happy to see both of you back as well for this meeting, after last meeting. So you said earlier that there were no issues with emergency braking yesterday. I can tell you that I was on a train that emergency braked quite hard in the tunnel yesterday, and I was told that it was actually because of the train losing contact with the transponder and therefore not knowing where it was, and it emergency braked. Whether or not that's the actual issue, I can tell you it braked pretty hard and it was pretty scary. Speaking of braking, these brake issues, if you wanted to.
You can comment to that if you
want.
I'm aware, I did see your tweet, and the train did EB, and it EB'd from 27 kilometers an hour, so it wasn't traveling at full speed. It did not miss a transponder. It did not lose communication.
Good to know. Even at 27 kilometers an hour, it's quite jarring, I'll tell you that. I was lucky that I was sitting. Brake issues. So we hadn't heard about brake issues until Councillor Meehan actually did that fantastic impromptu interview with the head of JBA, where he mentioned brake issues before. We hadn't heard about them before. So I'm just wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on what our issues are with these brakes.
So there's a task engineering task force team going on right now. So I can't elaborate too much because they're going through a root cause analysis. But the brake issues that we're experiencing, they're tied into, at times, into the emergency brake system. They seem to be mostly on the trailing bogey, so that's the bogey that doesn't have a motor on it. As I said, I do not have a root cause yet. What I can tell you is that every time it does occur, that we download the information from that particular vehicle, we look through the event recorders, and one of the things that we're doing, the JBA is doing, is looking for trends and causes. That's part of the task force team. So at this point in time, I can't give you more than that.
I'll be interested to see what the outcome is. So you mentioned root cause analysis. So since November, I may be mistaken though, it could be December, we have been hearing that we don't know the root cause for any of the issues. And we're hearing again today that there's, you know, root cause analysis is ongoing, even with something like the TCMS, which has been an issue for the longest, I think, that we still don't know what the root cause. So, I mean, I think we can all agree that we can't find a permanent solution to these issues until the root cause is actually known. I mean, patches and software updates are great, but we actually do need to know what the root cause is in order to solve these problems. So I'm wondering, what is the issue with determining the root causes for these known issues? Is it a resource issue? Is it a knowledge issue? Is it a vendor issue? What is stopping us from determining the root cause of issues that have been going on for months at a time?
So I think a large part of it is that the same resources are looking at a number of these issues. There's obviously a large volume of issues that have occurred at a similar time. Having people like JBA in to help is giving direction in specific areas. I don't want to sort of belittle it or what have you. These are very, very technical pieces of equipment. They're akin to an aircraft, okay? And drilling down through the thousands of lines of data and code that comes out of the event recorders takes an inordinate amount of time. And it takes a long time to see a pattern or a trend. There might be numerous brake issues that have occurred that provide the same result, i.e. a flat spot that we've been talking about, but there might have been several different occurrences that have triggered those, so you might not get a trend immediately. It just takes a matter of time. The TCMS issue that you mentioned, it is all software and it is code, and it takes an inordinate amount of time. The people that are looking at it are not here. The code was written in another country, and it's being analyzed in a huge amount of data. There's lots and lots of people looking at these things, and they're looking at it every day. It's not, don't for a minute think that people are not looking at this stuff, because they are. Because it's important, we all need to know the answer. And as soon as we have those answers, I mean, we know with the line inductors, we've done some analysis on that, and we're making changes, and we know where there's issues. Same with the doors, we're writing software, et cetera, et cetera. So things are coming, you know, we are getting to the root cause on some of them. Some of them, I understand, is frustrating. It's going to take a lot longer. It's just down to the volume of data we're getting and, you know, consistency.
Thank you. I can appreciate that. I'm glad to hear you mention the guideway intrusion detection systems and that you mentioned that they are turned off during inclement weather, i.e. snow, and I would assume it probably applied to rain as well. Are these detection systems, are they just overly sensitive and that's why you're having to turn them off because they're picking up snow drifts, for example, and breaking the terrain? Is that the issue?
So they are completely configurable. So, again, data, computers drive these things, and you can adjust the sensitivity of them. You can adjust the area they scan. You can adjust them for inordinate amount of different situations. And they require, I guess, fine-tuning. We went through a large part of that during the testing. And the sensitivity of them is something that needs to be looked at again, depending on different weather conditions. And it depends on, you know, what is, at what point is something an acceptable reason, cause for a trigger?
So if they just need to be realigned, for example, they need to be tweaked so that they're not so sensitive, why are we not tweaking them instead of turning them off? And I'm going to tell you what my concern is. Turning off an intrusion detection system, it's my understanding that it then requires the ERO, the electric rail operator, the driver of the train, to, you know, to watch for along the track. We have people at the stations, I understand, watching for things, humans, animals, whatever. But along the track, it would then be up to the ERO to watch for anything intruding into the path of the train. And so, correct? Because it's the intrusion detection system that stops the train if there's...
It's only at stations. It's not all the way along the alignment. It's at the ends of the platforms.
Okay, so it's just the ends of the platforms.
Correct.
Okay, that makes me feel slightly better.
And at the tunnel portals.
Okay. That makes me feel better, actually. Speaking of things on the tracks, so... Do we know what the debris was on the tracks that caused the damage to the transponders on the four trains?
There's a speed sensor bracket that's underneath, that's on the bottom of the train, and it jarred loose on Friday, and it took out four transponders. Since then, all those brackets, so there's been a fleet-wide check, they're all tight, but that's what it was on Friday. It was a speed sensor bracket.
Okay, so maybe I'm misunderstanding, because it was my understanding that the debris on the track took out transponders but also damaged four trains, correct, as a result? Or am I getting that wrong?
You're not far off. The what happened is we had four transponders that were damaged. Mm-hmm. And if you have more than two transponders damaged, the train loses position. Now, what that means, we're still communicating with the train, but it's because it's more than two transponders damaged. It can't find itself. It's still safe, can still operate, but you operate in what we call restricted manual mode. And what that means, I think, you know, there was comments on Twitter and the media about the reduced speed. Restricted manual means 25 kilometers an hour. And that's what occurred on Friday. The resultant damage, because the train couldn't find itself, it went into an EB, and that caused the flats.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. I only have two more questions, Mr. Chair, if that's all right. So clearly you are all very Twitter aware, and that's fantastic. So you were likely very aware of the comments about the vibrations and the noise, the extreme vibrations between Lees and Tremblay Station, so essentially around the Herdman Station area. It's pretty jarring. It actually drowns out conversation around you. That's how loud it is. And so I'm wondering if the cause of that is flat wheels, the track itself, a combination of the two. I understand if that's not something that you have knowledge on at this moment in time, but if you could commit to getting back to the commission on that I would appreciate that, because it is quite the topic of conversation. I've experienced it myself because I do ride the train daily. And it's getting worse. So if it's something you can look into, perfect. The final thing I want to ask you about is, so CFRA here in Ottawa sent an email to RTG yesterday asking for an update on the issues yesterday morning. In that email response that was received from the media relations team at RTG, they said, and I won't read the whole thing, but the last bit says, texts were on standby and the issues were addressed quickly without delay to service. So as someone who rides transit daily and I have a lot of people who message me about transit all the time, and also this is also a question from Councillor McKenney, who also heard it from her constituents. From what I can tell, yesterday morning people experienced delays anywhere between 15 and 30 minutes. So this isn't really a question, this is just a bit of advice. I don't think that it is necessarily a positive move for RTG to put out a statement that says there was without delay to service when customers very clearly experienced a delay to their service. It doesn't do anything to endear RTM to transit riders. And it doesn't look very transparent. And so my request would be is that And I can understand it may have been a copy and paste mistake. I don't know how you define a delay to service, but for customers, anything over 5 minutes, and we've had this discussion before with Mr. Manconi as well in commission, anything over 5 minutes impacts their lives. They miss their bus, they're late to work, they're late to pick up their kids, there's a lot of crowding. These are the types of things that anything more than 5 minutes is felt, and it's a visceral reaction from people. And so I just want to make the point that a response like that, where you're telling people publicly, telling media organizations, especially the reporter who got the response, who actually was delayed 20 minutes, it's not a positive move. And I'm just going to encourage RTM to look at their communications and to be a little bit more transparent with them. That's what I would like to say. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Vice Chair Cloutier, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the update and the information. Many questions have been asked. Mr. Lausch, you mentioned the inductors and that the power issue, and that one of the long term solution is to replace them. A short term release solution is to put some sheathing or some. But the long-term solution is to replace them. Why is that? The Alstom Citadis is the Alstom train. The Alstom Citadis was used in other areas. It is a the Spirit is specific to Ottawa. Is the inductors and that electrical system that we're using here different than what is being used in other locales with similar weather?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. Yes, to answer your question, it is different. The Citadis are used across the world, but sometimes at different voltages. Could be 1500, could be 750. They leverage an existing design, but it is the inductor design was specific to the Citadis Spirit.
Okay, thank you. And lessons learned for the stage two trains. All the changes we are making are being incorporated, and I'm looking at Mr. Morgan also, into stage two LRT tracks, switches, and trains.
Absolutely. Okay. Mr. Morgan and I have had this discussion, and the lessons learned and the modifications and the retrofits and so forth from stage one are all incorporated into stage two.
Okay. The other questions that I had have been asked. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chairs. Finally, Councillor Cavanaugh, please.
Thank you. Well, at this point, a lot of questions have already been asked, and I think we all want to get moving. But I just want to ask about wheel flats, because they've been occurring so much lately. I can't help but wonder about weather, because when I think of something flattening out regarding braking and slowing down, I think it would be more problematic in the warm months. And I'm wondering if is there any relationship to temperature? Because I'm wondering if are we going to continue to have these problems with the wheel flats?
The likelihood of having wheel flats is far greater in the winter than it is in the summer, purely because of the level of adhesion on the railhead from the wheels to the rail. It's not an occurrence that happens regularly in the summer. However, saying that, if you have an emergency brake situation, any time of year, there is a risk of flat spots.
Okay, but it's more
common. The risk of emergency brake application is far higher in the winter.
Okay, so this is more of a winter issue.
Correct.
Okay, and we're working on resolving that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. The other question, just very quickly, in terms of the graduates that we had, this is for Mr. Manconi, percentage of women, do we know?
Just looking to Mr. Hopkins if he knows. If he doesn't, I'll certainly get that back to you. He doesn't have it here, but we'll get it to you.
Thank you. That's it.
Thank you, Councillor. Councillor King.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering if staff could have JBA Corporation provide the commission with a written update on the reliability issues that they've been brought in to review.
So JBA does not work for the city. They work for Mr. Lausch. In fact, they have a non-disclosure agreement with the city, so you'd have to ask Mr. Lausch that.
So we provide the city with regular updates, and we have regular calls with the city where JBA participates. So the city is aware of what JBA is doing, but as Mr. Manconi said, they're contracted to RTM, not the city.
And so would there be any willingness to share any of that written material with the commission?
So Mr. Chair, the scope of work that JBA had with the city is a little bit different than they do with RTM. Their deliverable to the city was to do increased monitoring of RTM and to, I'm assuming, to generate a report at the end of it. The scope of work they have with us is more pragmatic. It's more they're integrated into our teams. The deliverables that they're providing us are some of the task force summaries. So there's fishbone analysis, there's root cause analysis, and so forth. There's what they call a fracas, and it's the top 10 list. So the deliverable, we're not expecting them to generate a full blown report on what they're doing, because as I said, they're pretty much integrated into our engineering teams right now.
Okay. So this is another question, I suppose, directed at staff. At the end of January, it was reported that transit staff were stationed on train platforms to whistle an all clear for train operators, as the CCTV and the operator cabs had been unreliable. I'm just wondering where we are in terms of the status of CCTV in the cabs.
So, Mr. Chair, since launch, we've had what we call platform spotters. They're actually RTM, RTG contracted personnel that are there. We've had them on the platforms, and they were there for a few reasons. One, it was a new system, new for our operators, new for our customers, and we wanted to put an extra layer of safety in there and have an extra set of eyes, so to speak, as we went through this major transition for customers. As well, though, that there were some, the CCTV system, I wouldn't say it was unreliable. It was operating at a very high degree of reliability, that around very high 90s, 98% sort of time period. But there were some isolated occurrences where the CCTV camera screens were popping up for the operator. There was some lag time issues. But the operator always has the ability to be able to go in, key, pull up the right station, and be able to make that view before they leave. But this was an extra layer of resources that we had directed. We asked them to put in place just to protect what could potentially happen. And we said we want that extra level of safety there for our customers. At this time they're still there. They're still performing a function. And as you've heard earlier, RTG is actually using them, the same resources, to deal with some of the issues with the GIDs. So they're performing more than one purpose right now, which has been a benefit to the service and to our customers. To say that the system's unreliable, I wouldn't say that's necessarily accurate. It is very highly reliable, and there has been some software updates that have continued to improve it. As I said, it was just an extra mitigation that we want to put in place.
So the extra spotters are obviously there for safety, which is of utmost importance, obviously, for the operations.
Yes, that's one of the key focuses that are there. And as I said, it's recognizing the fact that it was a new system for everyone, right? Our operators also always have the ability to call into the Transit Operations Control Center that see those same platform edges, and the operator always has the ability to speak to a controller who can confirm that it's safe to depart if they have other questions.
Okay. And another question to staff. In response to Councillor Dudas's inquiry about bus service reliability, it was stated that staff have been closely monitoring bus service, collecting extensive data, and reviewing feedback. Will that data be integrated ultimately into public tools accessible to transit users, such as the OC Transpo website or app, so that we could have a sense in real time? Because I know that's one of the challenges that residents are coming to me about. Our buses are canceled. We weren't aware that they were canceled. Will there be that type of data integration?
I'm going to let Pat answer it, but I also want to touch on something we're doing with BlackBerry has approached us to demo a software that speaks to exactly your point there about, it's great that data's there, but I want to know in real time if my bus is about to be canceled at my geographic location. They have told us they can do it, and this speaks to Councillor Kavanaugh's motion that's coming up, and it's in our business plan. They say they can do it. We're putting an integrated team to pilot it, test it in multiple languages and so forth. We're intrigued by that because you're getting into geocoding and it's specific to the rider, to your experience, to your route, to your location in real time. I think that's a real game changer in the transit industry if they're able to do it. Local firm, we're really looking to work with them and partner up with them. And then the data, I want Pat to be clear, because the short answer is we'll put out as much data as we can, and we have an open data policy also. So, Pat, did you want to comment on that?
Sure. Just to say that those data are available now. Different apps use the open data feed in different ways. When a trip is manually removed from the schedule, it is also removed from the open data feed. So a trip that has been canceled is no longer appearing when the open data feed provides a lot of data, and different apps are picking that up and using it and presenting it to users in different ways. But the decision on when to stop trying to fill that trip with one of these standby resources or extending a trip or overtime or finding some other way. So if a trip is likely not to be operated because the bus is delayed getting there, because the bus is held up somewhere else, because the bus is not available, the controllers are making many, many judgments, thousands of judgments a day on how they're going to fill every trip that we run, all 8,700 a day. They're working on every single one of them. If they see one is possibly not going to depart on time or at all, they're working to find it. The decision that when they reach the decision that they have no more solutions and that trip must be transmitted, customers must be advised that trip is not going to run, is a manual human decision. And that action, it being manual, is going to be a greater challenge to automate and provide data out than the already very complex math that we do now, which is a bus is coming down the street. When will it arrive where I am? Is the bus coming down the street? Yes, it is. When will it arrive? You're this far away. It'll probably take that long to get there. That's the primary data that our customers use. The cancellations are still a process which requires human intervention and typing at a keyboard. And we have a new dispatch system on its way. We have a new bus arrival time prediction at its way. Once we have those systems in, bedded down, worked out the problems with them, a possible future enhancement will be automating or moving closer to automation on communication of, we call them trip cancellations, but it's really when we've run out of ways to operate that trip.
So I guess noting that there is a lot of manual operations that are required to manage that data, and I'm supposing that impacts the quality of the data, the reliability of the cancellation information that our users are receiving. When we get these systems in place that have more predictability, et cetera, will we see an increase in the accuracy of the cancellation data that is reported to users? I'm just curious, how accurate is the cancellation data now? Is it 90% right? Is it 95% correct? And if we implement new technology and new software, where will we get to?
I'll try to clarify. I can't give you an accuracy of cancellation data that we provide to customers because we don't provide cancellation data to customers. We accumulate cancellation and all sorts of data about our service for diagnostic purposes, but we don't do that in real time. That's done sort of as the day goes on, looking back at the day. We provide alerts to customers through multiple channels, primarily through the web page and secondarily through subscription alerts and then also through the secondary Twitter feed. Those are alerts that are sent out, which are manually typed. You know, that you can see they're following a template, but they're created individually by actual people. We do not have a data stream on cancellation data. What we have is a data stream on service that is running, and it is possible it's not possible. We're providing positive information. The next bus coming to your stop is at such and such a time. If a trip is not there that you would normally expect in that time, then we don't provide information that would mislead you. Except, as we've been saying for many years, we cannot provide data until the bus starts moving on its trip. So someone who's waiting at, I always say at Kittiwake and Lime Bank, right? They're at the first stop on Route 262. Someone who's waiting at Tunney's Pasture Station, the first stop on Route 82 going west, we can't predict when that bus is going to move because the bus isn't moving yet. Controllers are working, the operators are working to get that bus moving, but we don't predict arrival times until the bus is moving. Now, with our new bus prediction software, which is being delivered by the supplier, there is more ability, and we have to learn. They're continually improving, but they've got a greater ability to look back into the history of what that bus would have been doing before it comes to that first stop. Is it coming off another route? Is it coming from the garage? How is it doing? Is it doing those things on time? That may allow us to give better prediction times before the bus has started its trip. But as I said, we may be able, in future generations of this software, to get to the point that the control actions where a trip has to be declared as canceled can be put into a data stream. But we do not have a data stream on cancellations now.
And do we have a timeline for that type of technology? I know we're talking about this predictive technology potentially with BlackBerry or QNX. Do we have an idea of when we'll be piloting that technology, potentially?
Councillor, if I can just interject, Mr. Scrimger, wouldn't that work a lot better under the next item, which is Councillor Kavanaugh's motion and report? The answers, or is that?
I think it's a continuing discussion. John, what do you want to say something about timing?
My answer is ASAP. That's the direction I gave them. They came in with a classic sales pitch. We can do this, this, this. And I heard loud and clear from all the counselors and our customers, accurate, predictable, specific to me. It's all about follow me on the journey. And I called them out. I said, look, if you can do that, you bring it in. I'll roll that out and do a pilot ASAP. And, you know, we're trying to get our customers as much information as possible to get that experience that you're talking about. I've got a meeting set up with our IT folks, with Invest Ottawa and that company. It's ASAP, and I told them it has to be bilingual. They even went an extra step. Maybe they got an automatic translator. They can do multiple languages. So as soon as we can, we'll pilot. The ball's in their court to move quickly.
Okay. And one more question, Mr. Chair. How does OC Transport define scheduled service delivery? And I'm thinking about the question that Commissioner Wright Gilbert had just really talked about, the idea that after 5 minutes, you know, your train or your service is delayed. The regular person would not consider that good service. So is scheduled service not delivered if there's a delay of more than 10 minutes, 20 minutes, or if the route is canceled?
Mr. Chair, I'd suggest that the best place for that discussion is in the discussion of the new performance measurement regime, which is one of the projects listed in the business plan, and one of the steering committees or working groups that the chair has established to help us with that. We continue to report on on-time performance using measures that were approved by the former Transit Committee over 10 years ago. Those are the reports that are available online. And we are working at a staff level, and we're in cooperating with that steering committee of councillors to find the best measures for us to report this in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Councillor. So is that report received? Received? Thank you. Okay. Now, next to final item, number five, GPS and user-friendly app system for buses to provide accurate information on bus location and cancellations. I believe there's a notice of motion on your part that you want to read first.
Yes, thanks. I believe everyone's got a copy, so why don't we cut to the chase, because everyone's hungry. And we'll talk about the guts of it. This is about the need for information and technology. And we've already heard that they're looking at different ways of dealing with it. I just want to emphasize the fact that this is about making the data available. It's not about OC Transpo developing it themselves necessarily. It's letting the information be available for other apps. And just to get more information out there, because this is a concern we're hearing about, that people don't have enough information. And I've had conversations with both Mr. Manconi and Mr. Scrimger about this, and we've already heard that they're looking at it. So I'll just read the final. Therefore, be it resolved that in 2020, OC Transpo prioritized bringing forward a reliable GBS and user-friendly app system on all buses to give accurate information on bus locations and cancellations to transit users.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Cavanaugh. So, did staff have any further comment on that, or we'll go to delegation?
We're supportive of it, Councilor.
Good. Okay. So, Justin Kelly, are you here? Okay. Do you want to come up? Maybe I can ask the clerk. Is it okay if Mr. Kelly sits in the chair here at the end so that everybody can stay at that other table? Is there any objection to that?
None by me, but I thought Mr. Lausch was no longer needed on this item.
Okay. Right there. Yeah, come on in here.
Push the button in the middle.
Okay. Great motion. So I didn't know about the BlackBerry thing coming into this, so this is a bit of news. I'm Justin Kelly. I'm now well known for Occasional Transport, which is tracking the LRT. And so I'm just here to talk about the importance of data. It's just a general message. So it's nice that we're moving towards opening up an API, and it's nice that we're trying to collect more data and make it more real time. I was just following along, and I just kind of want to say succinctly, I guess, why it's great that we're moving towards getting more OC data. I would push that we take a third-party consultation or open it up to a wider consultation and get more feedback from people that may have a vested interest with the city. There's a lot of people out there that can do this really cheaply, and they can provide the results that we're looking for, and they can do so in a time frame that's measured in months or weeks. Maybe not to the robust scale that an enterprise could do, but at least something that would fix the problems in the short term and that could be built out quickly into the long term. But yeah, with this new revelation with BlackBerry coming involved, it kind of changes my whole perspective here. But I just wanted to give my support to this, and I know the people that are being affected by the LRT definitely support more data accountability. And
Councillor Tierney has a question for you, please.
Great. I'll do it with staff and with the delegation, if that's okay. And John, you remember back in the day when we pushed pretty hard to get open data, and there was a bit of a cat fight on that. We had to use comparables like Winnipeg, and I think we're certainly getting closer. Mr. Kelly is here looking for more data, And I remember back in the day when I was chairing IT subcommittee, we were running hackathons and actually using some of the OC open data feeds. Would you think that would be a good way to go? I could speak to our chair of our technology subcommittee, Councillor Leeper, about him trying to get a hackathon going. I thought they were very valuable. It got a lot of knowledge throughout the city in one room. It was actually in this chambers, and they discussed different parameters and things that they would require in those feeds. Do you think there's a lot of value to that?
So definitely. I presume, not knowing anything, that the Invest Ottawa angle is where that's coming from. So there's some students or people within the city that are partnering to make a profitable for-profit group. They'll probably work with BlackBerry or some industry partner. They'll pitch it to the city and everyone wins because it looks good. But it costs money. That's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to be for-profit. So to your answer, yes. So if you get a bunch of people that are just vested in making the city a better place, get them in a room and see what they can do, yeah, that's great. But to add to that, transit data, all of this isn't new. It's very easy. The complication does come from the systems and the full integration, the buses having issues, the sensors on the bus not working, you have to have a bus moving. So there's that complication, but the underlying data, how it's in schedules and all that, that's not hard. And that's, you see it with hundreds and hundreds of apps, right? So. And it's open. It's
yeah, fun. Yeah. And again, yeah. We saw actually some really good stuff come out of a lot of our open data feeds, whether it was garbage collection. There was a lot of students from all the four major schools develop a whole bunch of great apps, and some of them are still in use today. I see some of the OC ones that were made third party that are out there. John, what are we looking at in the way of improved data feeds? Because I know right now we have some with lenses because there's some situations with travel times between places or dead zones. Is there any possible improvements to the open data feeds that we have right now?
It's all on the table. As you know, you and I led the charge on releasing open data from OC Transpo. Pat's already, he and I have talked already, that the Kavanaugh motion, the Councillor Kavanaugh motion, everything's on the table. If I don't have to pay to get the solution that you folks are looking for, we are absolutely considering hackathons. The speaker makes a good point about the complication of all the subsystems that need to talk, plus the upgrades that are going on, which is going to give us better data. So OC Transpo is more than willing, and we have shared data, and there's some great stuff out there that's already been leveraged. So everything's on the table, and if we don't have to pay for it, and quite frankly, I never told BlackBerry I was paying for it because the position was give it to us for free as a proof of concept, then they can go market it across North America. So there, I've shared my approach, my opening bid with them in public.
It's to their benefit for sure. So on that, thanks for hanging out all day, Justin. I'm sure that was a better result at the end of the day than you thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No other questions for delegations. Thanks for coming out. Is there any questions of staff? Councillor Cloutier, you had one. Anybody
thank
else?
You, and thank you, Councillor Kavanaugh, for bringing forward this motion and that it will be in the work plan for OC Transpo. Just want to ensure that as part of this, our paratranspo customers and in all its facets will be able to track their vehicles. I know in our conversations as part of the new app, customers will be able to track their minibus. Will this technology and GPS in that context be available on cabs and other vehicles that paratranspo customers might be using?
All paratranspo vehicles have GPS. Whether they are taxis or minibuses. That's been in place for some years now.
And all of that will be available for customers to track as part of the new app?
As part of the, not of this work here, but of the stage two, second phase of the online services that we talked about earlier this morning.
Thank you.
Councilor Kavanaugh.
Thank you very much. I'll just wrap up. I just want to give thanks to Councillor Fleury, who worked with me on this. He was looking in the similar vein. And to Mr. Kelly, who I believe was working with Mr. Fleury, or with Councillor Fleury, contributing because he had a long-standing interest in data release with OC Transpo. I think this is a win-win. It's about making information available. It's about making better customer service because when the information is there, people know when their bus is coming, they're going to be able to plan better. And I appreciate management's outreach to BlackBerry and to pushing forward on this initiative. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Kavanaugh. Is the report recommendation carried? Great, thank you. Okay, now moving on to item six, status update, Transit Commission inquiries, motions for the period of ending the 7th of February 2020. Is that received? Thank you. Status, we did that, the recommendation. There's no in-camera items. Notice of motion for consideration of subsequent meetings. Are there any notice of motion? Okay, seeing none. Are there any inquiries? I believe Councillor Olson had one that he asked Councillor Gower to submit on his behalf.
Yeah, I'm actually not ready to submit.
You're not ready.
Right now,
okay, sorry.
Recommended that he follow up with staff directly.
Okay, thank you. My apologies on that. Is there any other inquiries? Nope. Okay. Any other business? Okay, one thing I just want to mention under the other business, because it came up here earlier, there was two steering committees put together based on what we had said we wanted to do, and one was the PARA, which is Councillor Kavanaugh, Councillor Cloutier, Commissioner Caricato, and myself. And the working group on the reports is Councillor Suds, Councillor Gower, Mr. Scrimger, and myself. So there will be, this is very likely to evolve into a bigger working group, especially when we start bringing in the users of the system and so on to commit to this. And the objective of these working groups is to come back here to the commission so that the commission makes the decisions. It's really the steering committee is just going to help put together something for the commission to look at. Like, for example, with the reports, bring in some examples of the reports that we started working on putting together so that the commission can say, okay, that's the information we're looking for, or it's not. Okay, so are we clear on that? Is there any questions on that that I can answer or no? Okay, thank you. Then all we need now is a motion to adjourn. Gee, all the hands went up for that one. Okay, Carrie, thank you all very much, Mr. Marconi. Thank you to you and your team for the update today, and Mr. Lausch for joining us again, too.